Dr. Mary Steichen Calderon is known today as one of the most diligent and effective crusaders for a responsible, mature approach to the treatment of sex in the public schools. Her path to this position in society has been unusual. She spent her early years in France and in New York City. After graduating from the Brearley School in New York in 1922, she attended Vassar, where she studied chemistry. She majored in chemistry. She minored in music and drama. After receiving her BA degree in 1925, she went on the stage and became an actress. After a few years as an actress, she gave that career up and began searching for another career. She was involved in merchandising for a while. She took a Johnson O'Connor aptitude test in her search for a career and ended up at the University of Rochester School of Medicine. She just told me at lunch that maybe a year before she decided to get her MD degree, she was thinking of getting a PhD in nutrition, but changed her mind. So she received her MD degree at the age of 34, and she began the profession that is her true vocation at the age of 50. From 1953 to 1964, she served as medical director of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Eventually, she decided that handing out contraceptives was insufficient. So CECAS was established in 1965 with Dr. Calderon as the executive director. For those of you who might not know, CECAS stands for Sex Information and Education Council in the United States. The stated purposes of CECAS were to establish man's sexuality as a health entity, to identify the special characteristics that distinguish it from, yet relate it to, human reproduction, to dignify it by openness of approach, study, and scientific research designed to lead towards its understanding and its freedom from exploitation, to give leadership to professionals and to society, to the end that human beings may be aided towards responsible use of the sexual faculty and towards assimilation of sex into their individual life patterns as a creative and recreative force. Dr. Calderon is also a medical writer. She has published a number of books. She is a fellow of the American Public Health Association, a member of the American Medical Association and its Committee on Human Reproduction, and an affiliate of various organizations, including the American Association of Marriage Counselors, the National Council on Family Relations, and the Pan-American Medical Women's Alliance. She has served on the board of directors of the National Health Council and on the Commission of Family Life in the National Council of Churches of Christ and the Liaison Committee on Family Life Education of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She was a charter member of the Board of Directors of the Mental Health Association of Nassau County, New York, which conferred its Distinguished Service Award on her in 1958. I could go on for another 10 minutes, but I'm not going to read any more. The books that she has published and edited are in the program. And it is now my honor to introduce Dr. Mary Calderon to you.
That's all right, it doesn't matter. I do have a handout here, but I'm not sure there are as many as there are people. It's sort of the nub of what I'm going to be saying, so I didn't pass it out. Otherwise, you would have spent the time reading it. And I have a lot of other things to say, too. First, and number one, that this is a very special feeling for me, this assignment. To me, it's an enormous honor, because one of my things is the use of words. And of course, particularly in my field of activity, I've had to learn how to use words very, very carefully, the way the way minks do it, you know? No, hedgehogs. For instance, You mentioned the Seeker's Purpose. I was careful to use the word re-creative, and I had quite a time getting that hyphen in. I'm an editor too, you see. I didn't want people to think I meant recreational, although it's that too. You know? And when the Edward Browning Award was given to me by the American Journal, by the American Public Health Association, in my acknowledgement, I said, I want you to realize that I know I'm not trying to prevent any disease, but I have been trying to deal with a sexual dis-ease that we have in this country. And I feel very strongly about words. The other day in the Times, can doctors learn warmth? How can you ever learn warmth? If you have it into your life and you have an input of the warmth that I've had into my life, you can then give it out. So then the word was used was compassion. And I thought to myself, which meaning does he mean? If he means pity, to hell with it. If he means feeling with, empathizing, that's important. So again, learning to use words in exactitude in touchy and difficult areas is of great importance, and I'm willing to spend some time explaining words to people so they'll know exactly what I'm saying. Now, for instance, that little piece over there that was I gave, it was in the Seeker's Report, and I gave it at the International Congress of Sexology last May. I have been talking about it in various places when I give it out. The point is that it was picked up by UP and AP, and I've had clippings about this little tidbit that I'm going to be talking about in a minute from Australia, New Zealand, Sicily, India. And in an unguarded moment, I said, it's hard news, of course. It happens to be about fetal erection in the patient. So the first time I said that, there was that gale of laughter. The best one I ever saw was on TV when Gordon Drake, who attacked me in a scurrilous little pamphlet called Is the Schoolhouse the Proper Place to Teach Raw Sex? And they interviewed him on TV, and they actually got this moment when they asked him about what was so wrong about masturbation. He said, well, the trouble is it can get out of hand. That's no trouble at all. Well, anyway, Buckley, when he introduced me on Firing Line, put me at the end, as he does usually, of his target as a target, and he was introducing me as he generally does that way, and he said, and she was on the stage, I don't think she's ever left it. Right. I use everything that's ever been given to me, and the 3 years on the stage was marvelous. Anyway, now I'll get serious. In your AV session this morning, there was a talk about CNN news, a new role of cable and so forth, and it's still in evolution, obviously. But the phrase foremost medical personalities for credibility came to me. I heard it, and the mention was of DeBakey. Obviously, he was one of those, and I thought, am I a foremost medical personality? Foremost. I'm not the hindmost, that's for sure. Okay. And that's not funny. Also, alone, you know, I really am not the hindmost. I am out there in front, taking the slings and arrows along as accepting the leadership, because I believe in it. I'm a Quaker, and boy, when Quakers get concerns and beliefs, watch out. We really hang on and hang in. Personality. I realize that if I'm ever to write my autobiography, I've got to write it in response to the most frequent question, how did you, meaning, how did a nice old lady, octogenarian great-grandmother, ever get so interested in sex? Well, the long way around is to talk about my life and Planned Parenthood and its role and serendipity. But the shortcut is the one I usually take, which means I was born that way. And that's not funny. It's true. And that's what I'm going to be coming to. You see how words are important, what you're conveying is important, and you can laugh, and it's still good. It's still okay. You're not... As Thoreau suspected the man who made jokes about sex, and I do too, because it's fine to make jokes because a lot of them are funny, but if you're not serious about it too, if you're just using the jokes as a cover-up, then you know you're not comfortable with your own sexuality. And this is what Father John Thomas said way back in 1962 at a speech to Planned Parenthood. Human beings will never solve their population problems until they've come to terms with their own sexuality. And of course, when Secus was formed, he immediately became a member of the Secus board, and he wrote the second piece in the Secus newsletter saying, sexuality and the total personality. To him, sexuality is a part of the total personality structure. He struck a keynote there that was of very profound importance. And of course, I am medical in a sense, not that I have an MD, but that I have facts that I like to share with as many people as possible. So you have this quick rundown on where I've been in my life, where I was, having two children in my 20s, in my 30s getting my medical degree and public health degree and internship and remarrying, and in my early 40s having two more children, so that when I was ready to go to work, having seen them into full all-day school, I was 49, and I never went to work before that. I don't call being a school physician work. It was really fun. Now, in the years of Planned Parenthood, which was 11 years, I was very, very careful then, and this was where my medical and public health training came in, to stick to the facts. At the time that I came in, I remember the Journal of the AMA had something called New and Non-Official Drugs, which was its little booklet about various forms. And under contraception, they discussed learnedly, they were not learned about diaphragms and condoms, but they were very learned about the relative merits of vinegar and lemon juice douches. And this is where I came in, you see, because I looked at this thing. I said, it's a horror. It's terrible. It doesn't even give such facts as they are. So I wrote complaining, being medical director of the Planned Parenthood Federation. I wrote complaining, and they wrote back and said, why don't you rewrite it? And I said, I will. And I got the four professors of obstetrics and gynecology in the four medical schools in New York City to sit on the committee, and we wrote it. They couldn't turn down what we wrote. It was wonderful. I couldn't have done that, but they could do it. Now, we see that you have concepts that are negative as well as positive in Planned Parenthood, family planning. You have to prevent babies. Well, that's overpopulation. Or the techniques of birth control. That is a technology. I was always interested in the people who were having the babies and in, therefore, the health of the persons who were creating a family most of the time. In those days, one did create families and got and more or less stayed married. The poor were not involved in this at all because nobody, when I first went in as medical director, historically speaking, I had nothing to do with this, nobody in any public health service, public supported services, could get any contraception. In 1953, in 1954, and so forth, it was primarily a bootleg operation in the physician's, private physician's office. This is hard to remember, you see, that's only 30 years ago, isn't it? 50, 80, yes, 30 years ago, that's all it is. And it was not until 1959 that I persuaded the American Public Health Association that a policy declaration was indicated. And they came out with a positive policy declaration on family planning as a health program, as a health practice. But the AMA didn't come along until 1964. By that time, I had needled them after with a letter to the trustees every year saying, you'd better take a policy, it's time, and so forth. And one year they finally said, yes, we're setting up a committee, will you be on it? And I knew we were home free because by 1964 they actually had a delegate voting for the policy that family planning is not just responsible parenthood, it is responsible medical practice. So that's when I could quit. I always quit jobs when I was successful. I did that when they raised my salary as a school physician, and the superintendent said, why are you quitting? And I said, because I wasn't earning it before, and I'm earning it even less now, so goodbye. That, you see, is very important to me. I've always wanted to be in something that was extremely meaningful that nobody else could do, or few people could do. And serendipity had, when I was ready to go to work, had Planned Parenthood calling me and offering me the job. The other one, though, with CECAS, and those are the only two jobs I've ever held, was not serendipity. We engineered it. When I say we, by then there was a whole group of us meeting for 4 or 5 years previously, saying what's wrong with this society. Our attitude about sexuality are messy, they're exploitive, they're crude, they're unrealistic, they're all of these negative things and very few positive things. What are we going to do about it? And finally, I brought in some yellow sheets of paper that outlined a voluntary health organization on the same format as Planned Parenthood, with a staff and with a non-profit and also a board. And that's when we formed CECAS in 1964, properly, with a charter and all the rest of it. I'm interested in sharing with you the fact that about 5 years after that, yes, 6 years after that, World Health Organization, which had defined health in the following way, a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not just the absence of disease or infirmity. It's an excellent positive definition of health. And I wanted a similar thing for sexual health as a concept. You see, sexuality as a health entity was the keynote. Just as I had put family planning into the field of health, I wanted to put sexuality and our concern about it into the field of health. And so sexuality is a health entity. People said, what do you mean sexuality? It took 3 years for that word to be understood. Now everybody uses it. We know what we mean by it. The total person, as male or female, with all of that person's genes and intrauterine life and life following birth, experiences, learnings, yearnings, desires, fallacies, everything. That is you, as you sit here, each one, a unique sexual person. Nobody else before or since will ever have exactly the same pattern of those factors that you have, each one, and me. I'm a unique sexual person. And I think what we fail to tell our children is you're unique mentally, you're unique physically, and you're also unique sexually. And this is what I'm getting to. The use of words and the use of concepts, basic concepts. So the World Health Organization defined sexual health. After a meeting, 5-day meeting in Geneva, they flew us in. 18 countries represented by 28 physicians. 18 countries accepted the invitation. And the committee formed this particular. We didn't leave until we had formed this definition of sexual health: the integration of the somatic, the mental, and the social aspects of sexual being. See, they're building on that previous health definition in ways that are positively enriching and that enhance personality, communication, and love. That's an extraordinary definition for a World Health Organization to have put out. I'm surprised that it's always had so little observance. You have to stop and think of the meaningfulness of that, because if you think of the newborn infant, as I will be in a minute with you, of the newborn infant as already a sexualized person, and this fetal erection has shown it, then you have to understand that you're going to have to deal not just with two of the three aspects that make us human, that make this baby human, but three, the third. We are unique among all living beings in our bodies. No other living being can stand up and use the hands and do all the things that we do with our hands, invent and write and run a computer as I love to do and so forth, and make love, because touching is one of the great sex organs. The skin is the largest sex organ in the body. We're not used to thinking of it. The baby is born with a skin. And the first touching with the mother is its first truly sexual experience after the erection it's been having reflexly in the uterus. Now, the body, the mind, the computer mind, we make binary decisions. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Every decision we make is a binary. It's very interesting how our computer minds are hardwired at birth to respond specifically to the mother. The mother's voice has been in that ear for a number of months, and Cambridge University has films showing that the baby's body moves in rhythm with that voice and not in rhythm with the voice of a stranger uttering the same words as the mother. We have all sorts of indications that the baby is born a person already, with experiences and all of its functions functioning, except one. One system in the body isn't functioning at birth. The reproductive will not function until puberty. So what is functioning? The sexual response system. A totally different system, totally different purposes, functions throughout the lifespan of the individual. And that's the proof, erections in the uterus. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if someday we would be able to say that the baby girl has clitoral erections in the uterus. We know that she begins vaginal lubrication at birth. We have that now. We have all sorts of very good research that tells us. So that is the third aspect of being human that we must now learn to deal with positively instead of negatively. Not in snide ways, not in embarrassed ways, but straightforwardly and simply, as we deal with any other aspect of life. It is a part of us. And I want to point out, I haven't done anything in the schools for years and years and years. Actually, after the first 4 or 5 years with Seekers, which would have been until 1968 or 9, the schools were after us, and when the John Birch Society and Christian Crusade got after us, the schools dropped us like a hotcake because it was too dangerous in their communities. Now, there are only about 10% of the schools have on their own, autonomously set up sex education programs. So really, I have nothing to do with the schools. I am particularly concerned in the preschool child. I don't feel that anything that schools can do can ever take the place of what parents fail to do. I do not agree that parents have a right to do the sex education of their children. They don't have a right, they have an obligation. It's the children that have a right to have parents who'll do it, and do it well, not in ways that cripple and distort and lay heavy hand of sin on something that God gave us and has inborn us. Not at all, but in a way that is open and fresh and warm and true. What's at stake here? The future husband or wife is at stake, not just your child and your little darling. Many, many men and women are having to deal now with what their parents did to them in all good faith, and my mother did it to me, but in all good faith, parents do the wrong thing. We act as if knowledge betrayed innocence, when knowledge bolsters innocence and simply betrays ignorance. You see, knowledgeable innocence is wise innocence. Innocence can be all sorts of things. It cannot be pure innocence or not knowing. It cannot be confused with ignorance. Parents do this. My little baby isn't sexual. He's innocent, or she's innocent, particularly she's innocent. Of course she's innocent. She's fortunately innocent of an awful lot of the stupid things the parent knows or believes. But unfortunately, she's going to grow up and get those things unless the parents are willing to learn. And that, of course, is what I'm trying to lay out in the society, to produce in the society the willingness of parents to learn or relearn if they started out wrong. It's never, never too late. 3 years ago, I was invited to write a little editorial, a note in American Journal of Diseases of Children, Diseases of Children. And I did, and I wanted the pediatrician, and showed why he should ask, among all of the other questions he asks at the 6 months examination after diet, sleep habits, whatever else, how's he doing, so forth, and how do you feel, how does it make you feel when your little boy touches his penis, or when your little girl touches her vulva? How does it make you feel? Well, I didn't get one single response, pro or con. Not any interest was evinced from those pediatricians. Why? Well, pediatricians are people just like us. And nothing in the medical curriculum, I assure you, ever taught me that masturbation was really a normal part of being a human. That it was something that was given to us to use, to learn how to use, to learn to be private about, because everybody likes privacy for this and for any kind of sexuality. And so socialization begins at 2, when you can point this out to the child. The best place for that is in your own little room, in bed. That's where it's comfortable, and we'll close the door. And I'll never come in when your door is closed without knocking first, and you won't do it with Daddy and me either. Well, when I went to medical school, I was assigned to a male cadaver. Nothing was ever said about the penis. There it was. There were 2 women and 2 men on that cadaver. We did the entire dissection. We never mentioned what we didn't dissect. One day, it came to us that the women had an appointment. They were to go and feel a prostate. Now, it turned out that in medical school, I was in medical school in 1936, 37, 38, and so forth. Well, every patient on the gynecological floor was examined vaginally, private or non-private patient, by every medical student once she was anesthetized. It was a gold mine of information. We felt all of the tumors and all of the possible pathology, pelvic pathology that the people were being operated on for or observed them. But the women had never felt a prostate. We were not assigned to the genitourinary floor, which was a male floor. So one day we all were told that we were gowned and masked and capped. And we went upstairs to the GU floor, and we went in, and every door along that big corridor was closed, and we marched past following the male GU specialist. There were no females in those days. And we went into one of those rooms, and all of the curtains were around all the beds in that room. There were 4 beds, and we went in, and there was a figure on the knee chest position already, covered over completely except for one little opening. And with gloves and Vaseline, we each one felt a prostate. I still don't know what I felt. I never had a chance to recoup that one. Meanwhile, every male student was able to ask questions with the anesthetized patients, feel all of the, as I say, the pathologies, the various pathologies, and so forth. That is what I call sex discrimination. There are now some women GU specialists. Now, the second thing that happens, second socialization, the first is the child learns that it is a boy or is a girl, learns that absolutely irrevocably by the age of 2. That is good research. After that, the parents are very busy trying to teach the child what kind of boy, what kind of girl they want. That's up for grabs today. Oh, that's changing, and I won't even go into it because you know as well as I do how it's changing. So the third and important thing is the acceptance and understanding of the evolution, the nature and evolution of childhood eroticism. And the best child psychiatrists now, Albert Salnit at Yale School of Child Development, I've been on a program with him, and with James Anthony, who was the very first professor of child psychiatry in this country. And he's held the same chair in St. Louis for 25 years now. I got him to come to the Sexological Congress last May and speak on children's sensuousness and the essentiality of it. Children are sensuous little people. They want to use all their five senses, and they want to use this particular thing, and we can help the whole concept of yourself as a sexual person as being a rounded person because you are sexual. You have a mind, you have a body, and you have your sexuality. Your sexuality is your way of learning you, yourself, intimately, because someday you will be learning somebody else intimately, sexually, too. This is the bond, the sexual bond between people, is first formed with oneself. Learning to trust one's own sexuality is very, very important for small children, and learning of its acceptability to the parents. This, we could take away this one thing, this lack of trust, this idea that it's dirty or sinful, particularly to mix religion in with sex is heinous, really. Masters and Johnson and other sex therapists have identified two primary causes for sex, the need for sex therapy. One is interference with early childhood masturbation, and the second is a rigidly orthodox upbringing. It makes no difference whether it's non-religious or whether it's Protestant, Jewish, or Catholic. It's the authoritarianism and the didacticism that is dangerous to the full evolution of a warm, flowering sexuality that is totally responsible. That word, of course, has to come in there. And it can, because once children are 6 and 7 and are well-oriented to sexuality and me sexual and everybody sexual and we have our responsibilities, then you can begin feeding in at school what the parents don't know enough about, which is the information about sexuality. It's really solid information. Eric Johnson does this and has done it for years at Germantown Friends. He was my co-author on the family book about sexuality, which is receiving very good acceptance from early childhood educators on behalf of families. And the idea is feed in the information. Children by puberty, should have all information about contraception, all information about venereal diseases, those are the negatives, all information about prostitution and other exploitive uses, all information about the true nature of homosexuality, which nobody knows the cause of, but everybody understands is like left-handed and right-handed, and that's about the only difference we need to make of it, because it doesn't affect the life of the society at all. All societies have had homosexuals, and we just make a big thing of ours because we don't understand it well enough. As I remember being asked by Cavett on his show, what would I really like to learn more about? And I said, yes, I really would like to learn something. I really would like to learn about the causes of heterosexuality. And his Adam's apple moved up and down 3 times. I saw it. And he said, why do you want to know that? I said, it stands to reason. We don't know the cause of homosexuality, but if we knew the cause of heterosexuality, I bet you we'd know the cause of homosexuality. That's how simple it really is, you see. And plus the facts that homosexuals don't rape and molest and so forth, and heterosexuals rape. They rape homosexuals and heterosexuals. It makes no difference. Anyway, these are facts. They're not just dreamings up in my silly, stupid, sexy head. They are facts, and I deal in facts. So that if anybody asks my opinion, I have to say to them, I do not have opinions, I have facts, and I'll give them to you. The awful fact that was revealed in a beautiful study by Nancy Blackman, Dr. Blackman at University of Rhode Island, when she studied 4 and 5 year olds and discovered that the area between the navel and the knee is a not me area. Doesn't belong to me. I can name every part of the body and give its functions except that area. Now, this is a very busy area, you must admit. Profoundly interesting, attractive, fascinating, pleasurable things happen in that area, and the child knows about it, experiences it every day. Nobody's ever given names to what happens there, to the organs, the proper names. What girl has ever grew up knowing she had a clitoris? She has a vagina now. We sort of lamely admit that she has a vagina. Well, a vagina is not the point. Vulva is a much better word because vulva includes all of those wonderful things that happen there. That a boy has to have, has only one organ for doing, and girl has three organs for doing. Did you ever think of that? Clitoris for pleasure, meatus for urinating, vagina for childbearing someday, and also for sexual pleasure when you're grown up. Boy only has one organ for that. That's the answer to the girl who wonders why she doesn't have a penis. You don't have a penis because if you had a penis, you'd be a boy, but you're a girl. Look what you've got. And here's a mirror and here's a flashlight. Now, I'll hold the flashlight. Now, I am going to stop because I think I've said enough. The language of sex and sexuality is beautiful. Why anybody wants to say you've got a wee-wee instead of you've got a penis is beyond me. And I was delighted to learn that in Anglo-Saxon days, the Latin words were vulgar and crude. The words we now think of as vulgar and crude are the ones that were the proper ones to use. And that's a neat switch, isn't it? And shows how the problems are up here. They're rarely down here, unless we cause them, and we're causing them, in our children. We should not be causing them. We should not have marriages that are in trouble because of what our parents did not do. I don't fault my mother. She put aluminum mitts on my hands so I wouldn't abuse myself, put that in quotes, the way Mrs. Roosevelt put mitts, aluminum mitts on Anna Roosevelt's hands. That's in her diary. The fact is, you see, that the whole medical profession was saying, do not let your children abuse or pollute themselves because such and such will happen to them. So our parents, out of fear for us, did what they thought was the right thing. We can't afford that kind of stupidity and ignorance anymore. It's cruelty. And I look upon interference with any childhood function, with between the child and the child's own body, The child owns its body. The mother and father do not own that child's body. And interference between the child and its body is to me a powerful form of child abuse. It really is, because of the results it can have. Now, when you hear about Mary Calderon saying terrible things, I've said them all to you today. They're not terrible in the light of reason. And I'll come now to the one last thing. The Goldmans did a magnificent study, probably the best sexual study in terms of construction that's ever been done. You cannot fault it. It's called Children's Sexual Thinking. They are Australians. It was published last May, and they studied 850 children in Australia, North America, and England. They had a control group in Sweden. They did not study their sexual behavior, nor their sexual attitudes, nor their sexual knowledge, except indirectly. What they were studying was the way they thought about such knowledge as they had been given. The children's ages were from 5 to 15, and 854 children is a very, very good sampling. They found that, well, they would ask a question like this: how do you tell a boy baby from a girl baby when they're first born? If the child used sex terms, they could then go on and ask other questions using sexual terms. Otherwise, they kept right on non-sexual terms. They found that the children in our country, in North America, on the Canadian board there, both sides, were 2 years retarded to the Australian and the British children. Incapacity to think logically and rationally about sex. They were the ones that were full of myths and misinformation from 5 to 15 years of age, just when they should have been getting all of the correct information. Our children are 2 years retarded. All the English-speaking children were 5 years retarded compared to the Swedish sample. And that's to be expected. They've had compulsory sex education in the schools for 2 generations now. They're already into the third generation of having children have early sex education. Correctly done, correctly given. It's not warm and loving as parents can do it. That's the only thing I fault about any school programs. So I want to warn you that we are getting excellent research. We're finding out with this new little tidbit that every lecture I gave last year, I said, if there are any sonographers or you know any people who do sonography, please get me a sonograph of fetal erection. Everybody knows about that. I said, no, we've heard about it, but we haven't seen it. We want to see it. We, meaning sexologists. And by golly, 3 people sent me, this is the best one, you're getting it, you'll get it in the handout. And the interpretation of it is, as I indicated, that we are sexual and all of our systems are functioning. Now, with that in mind, we need to support any efforts in our communities, whenever we have a chance in reviewing books, whenever we have a chance to meet with people who deal with people. Public libraries in New York, stocking my book, my co-authors in my book, because they're under tremendous demand that hasn't been done before, to draw early childhood educators and parents draw their attention to these facts. Whenever we get a chance to, we should do it, because the sooner we do it, the better. Remember that in child abused children, 31% have been born prematurely. In contrast to non-abused children, only 7% in the general population. 3 times as many children were prematures if they are abused children in the abused child population, which means that first 2 months is vital as bonding, and you're going to have difficulties with parents who do not understand the nature, the sexual nature, and the beauty of bonding and touching the skin and so forth. We're all afraid. It's about time for me to stop. It's 5 of 1, right? 2. No, 1. 2. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Calderon, and I'd like to present from the American Medical Writers Association a certificate demonstrating our appreciation and an honorary.
Oh, thank you. I'm very proud of this. And I'd like to tell you one quickie, because you stood up, and that makes me think of the last time somebody stood up for me was in the subway not too long ago. When I got on, a man got up and gave me a seat, and I thought, thanked him, and I said, that doesn't usually happen, thanks, special thanks, and I went on reading or whatever, and I suddenly realized he was leaning towards me. I thought, what gives? And I looked up, and I suddenly saw him. He was poorly dressed, uncouth looking, ungainly looking, middle aged. And as he spoke in a very raspy voice, I thought, what is he going to say? He leaned over me, and in the most incredible tenderness, he said, we all owe you so much. And when you stood up for me then, I got the same thing I always do when I tell that story. Thank you very much.
You're all invited.